Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day to help you learn and improve your American English skills. Remember, we always tell you interesting and important stories from around the world in a special way. We speak more slowly than normal. We also use words and sentences that are easier to understand. If you want to learn English even faster, be sure to download the podcast and save it on your computer. That way you can go back and listen and practice whenever you want. Today we have two stories for you. The first one is about a militant group in Nigeria that may threaten neighboring Cameroon. What is happening? What is Cameroon doing about the situation? Then something a lot less serious and lighter. There are plans for a new art display deep under the ground here in Washington, D.C. If you have visited our nation's capital in the past, or plan to come here soon, you won't want to miss this story. Okay, let's get started with part one. The Central African nation of Cameroon is taking steps to guard against attacks from Boko Haram militants. The government has deployed troops to all major towns to search people, goods, businesses, and even private homes. Now, Cameroonians of all ages are learning to deal with the increased security. Bob Doty has more on the story.
On va fouiller les sacs là. Fouiller tout le monde.
A soldier gives search orders at the main train station in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. It is the first time railroad passengers have been asked to line up and pass through a metal detector. If no metal object is found, they are free to continue moving and get on their train. Susan Ngam is a member of the armed forces. She says the government deployed her and other soldiers to towns across the country after 4 Boko Haram suicide bombings last month.
Here we search everybody. We search the customers. We search the employers.
Businessman Emmanuel Ngufor is traveling to northern Cameroon. He admits the increased security has led to delays, but he welcomes the effort.
It's for our security. We can never tell, judging from the looks of people. So it may be inconveniencing, but inasmuch as we know that it's for our good, it is worth it.
Last month, about 60 Cameroonians were killed along the border with the Nigerian state of Borno. Nigeria is home to Boko Haram supporters. The militants used female suicide bombers in the 4 bombings. Bernard Okala Bilai is the governor of Cameroon's southwest region. He says the government has called for increased security all over the country.
In the church, in the market. If you suspect a face, don't hesitate to ask the man who he is without any provocation, without any threat, without any violence.
Defense Minister Edgard Alain Mebe Ngo says he has urged business people, schools, and churches to employ private security agents. He says security forces have been working hard, but they need the support of every Cameroonian. He says everyone should be educated to help in fighting Boko Haram until the group has left Cameroon. He says the country will only develop a healthy economy when there is peace. Boko Haram was founded in northern Nigeria. It has threatened to attack Cameroon because the country supports the Nigerian military's campaign to defeat the group. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The DuPont Circle Park in Washington, D.C. is a busy, crowded place. Popular restaurants and businesses around the circle attract many city residents and visitors. But few people know about the old streetcar station below the street. Jill Robbins knows its secrets.
Braulio Ignesi is the managing director of an organization called DuPont Underground. The group wants to change the old station into a place for the arts.
So we see everything from site-specific artwork that fills the space in different ways, light and sound, or installations. Or it could be used like a traditional gallery, but also as a curved space, it also offers a chance for new kinds of performance. The DC has quite a few experimental theater groups that like to work in unusual spaces and do different kinds of production.
The system of tunnels was built in the late 1940s, but the streetcars only used it for a short time. They stopped running in the 1960s. Mr. Ignesi says the station could become a symbol of how quickly Washington is changing.
Changes in the last 5 to 10 years have been tremendous. The restaurant scene is changing, new development, new opportunities. And we think there's an opportunity to create something here that helps the city move forward.
DuPont Underground is just one example of the trend toward giving a new purpose to unused industrial sites. In New York, builders want to make a forgotten streetcar garage into a park below the street. And New York already has the popular High Line Park. It was once an old railroad path. The question is, can DuPont Underground be as successful? Bill McLeod is executive director of Historic DuPont Circle Main Streets. The group helps small businesses in the DuPont Circle area. Mr. McLeod says the underground will fill a need in the area.
I think there's definitely a need for an art space or an event space in DuPont, and I think that would be the perfect space to activate because it's actually very large. It's about 70,000 square feet, and it could be really very cool.
Another organization tried to open a group of eating places in this space 15 years ago. That food court project failed. Mr. McLeod says the group leading the new effort has a better understanding of the project. He says the group knows it will take a lot of time and money and is successfully seeking financial support. Braulio Ignesi and his co-workers hope to open the underground station to the public in the next few months. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to The Voice of America. We come to you each day from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Education experts say Africa's growing higher education system is important to its economic development. But African universities face a number of issues, including emigration of top students, poor infrastructure, and high demand combined with a lack of funds. University leaders from around the African continent met in Johannesburg last week to discuss how to solve these issues and others. The academics who attended the African University Summit say the job of educating Africa's students is harder than it has to be. Engineering professor David Mfinanga is a vice chancellor at the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. He says the main problem facing universities is the high number of students.
Most countries are trying to increase the number of university graduates because it is important for economic development. But the resources are limited, so that affects quality as well. And therefore, we are struggling to balance the two because you need the quantity, you need more graduates, but you need to maintain the quality, and the resources are limited.
Pinky Mekwe is an administrator at the University of Johannesburg. She says schools face another problem, money. Like many American universities, she says, African universities struggle for funding. But unlike American schools, African schools cannot ask students to pay more tuition. And the 2009 global economic crisis reduced African governments' budgets. So, Ms. Mekwe points out, universities now receive even less funding. Usman Sen is director of the Senegal-based West African Research Center. He says governments also need to look at the result of having many university graduates, but few job opportunities.
What are you going to do with them if they just get out of university and they are out of a job? Because this is a real threat. This is a real conflict-ridden situation in Africa, having these thousands and thousands of graduates, postgraduate students, qualified with plenty of degrees, expecting everything from society and spending years milling the ground without getting a decent job. That's a real problem.
There are no simple answers to the issues that African universities face. But African educators say the issues are just as serious as many of the continent's other difficult problems, such as war, famine, poverty, and quickly changing leaders. And in this case, they say, solving higher education's problems may help solve the others. For the VOA Learning English Education Report, I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of the United States Constitution. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders
met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. They created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we discussed the way the delegates agreed that states would be represented in the national government. There would be two houses in the legislature. In one house, the House of Representatives, the number of representatives from each state would depend on the state's population. In the other house, the Senate, all states would have an equal number of representatives. The agreement on representation was known as the Great Compromise. Not all the delegates in Philadelphia were pleased with it, but it saved the convention from failure. The debate on representation in the House raised an important issue. No one wanted to talk about it, but all the delegates knew they had to discuss it. The issue was slavery. There were thousands of slaves in the United States in 1787. Most of them were in southern states. But there were many slaves in the north, too. And northern ship owners made a lot of money by importing slaves from Africa. A modern-day Supreme Court justice, Clarence Thomas, came from a family whose ancestors included slaves. Justice Thomas says slavery made no sense in America.
How can you have a free country with slaves? We understood that. It's a contradiction. It contradicts the very founding premise of the country.
The Articles of Confederation said nothing about slavery. Each state could decide to allow it or not. Massachusetts, for example, made slavery illegal. Nine other states stopped importing new slaves. Only three states, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, continued to import slaves. The issue was never easy to discuss. Some of the most important men in America, including George Washington and James Madison, owned slaves. No one wanted to insult these men, yet the delegates at the convention had to make some decisions about slavery. Slavery affected laws on trade and taxes, as well as the question of representation in Congress. If the number of representatives in the House was based on a state's population, who would you count? Would you count just free people, or would you count slaves too? Akhil Reed Amar, a professor of law and political science at Yale University, calls slavery the original sin of America's founders.
They inherited it, to be sure, and they worried about it, but not enough.
During the debate, some delegates argued that slaves were property and should not be counted for purposes of representation. Others argued that slaves were people and should be counted with everyone else. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania made an angry speech. He denounced slavery as an evil institution. Charles Pinckney of South Carolina defended the existence of slavery in the United States. In all ages, he said, one half of mankind have been slaves.
George Mason of Virginia, a slave owner, wanted to free all slaves. He said Virginia attempted to do that when it was a British colony, but that the British government refused. He blamed the problem on British businessmen who made money from slavery. Other delegates rose to denounce or defend slavery, but no one at the convention had the power to rule on whether slavery was right or wrong. Everyone knew the convention would fail if they tried to write a constitution that banned slavery. The southern states would never accept it. They would refuse to be part of the United States. Rufus King of Massachusetts said, "The convention should consider slavery only as a political matter." And that was what happened. The delegates accepted several political compromises on the issue. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, for example, proposed a method of counting each state's population for purposes of representation. All white people and other free citizens would be counted as one person each. Every five slaves would be counted only as three people. This was called the three-fifths rule. The delegates accepted it. The word slave was never used in the Constitution. The document simply used the words all other persons. The three-fifths rule remained the law until the 14th Amendment to the Constitution came into effect in 1868. Alexander Hamilton said the three-fifths compromise was necessary. Without it, he said, no union could possibly have been formed. Slavery also became an issue when the delegates began discussing the powers of the national legislature. Once again, the delegates asked, are slaves people, or are they property? The answer would affect import taxes and the growth of new states. The delegates accepted several compromises on these questions, too. They agreed that the Treasury could collect a tax of $10 for every imported slave. They also agreed that slaves could be imported until 1808. Then, no new slaves could be brought into the country. Until then, each state had the power to make its own decisions about slavery. After 1808, the national government would make all the decisions. Constitutional law professor Akhil Reed Amar says that agreement is where the delegates went wrong.
What was the founders' biggest mistake? Not that they didn't get rid of slavery immediately. It was already a part of their world. It would have been difficult to get rid of slavery immediately. But what they didn't do is come up with a long-term plan to get rid of slavery eventually.
Debate on the Constitution continued through the summer of 1787. At the same time, some of the delegates raised an important question. Once the document was written, who would approve it? The state legislatures? The people? or, as Governor Morris proposed, one big national convention. Elbridge Gerry opposed giving that power to the people. The people, he said, have the wildest ideas of government in the world. James Madison disagreed. He believed the people must ratify their new plan of government. Madison considered the difference between a system founded on the legislatures only and one founded on the people to be the true difference between a league or treaty and a constitution. When the debate was over, the delegates agreed that the people should ratify the new constitution through conventions held in each state. Justice Clarence Thomas and law professor Akhil Reed Amar have described this agreement as one of the most remarkable parts of the convention.
You think of the going to Washington and trying to get him to leave Mount Vernon, and he doesn't want to leave because he's finally back home. He'd been away over 4 years, and he doesn't want to leave. And he goes to Philadelphia, and they do it. They come up with this document, what, 4 months. And now you have it. It's going to the Congress, and it's going to be sent to the people to...
To the people.
To the people, amazing. To ratify.
Amazing.
Finally, the delegates had to decide how many yes votes by states would be needed to ratify the Constitution. Any changes to the Articles of Confederation needed ratification by all 13 states. The Philadelphia Convention was called only to change those articles, not to replace them. So all 13 states would have to approve. But several delegates said this would be impossible. After all, Rhode Island never sent a representative to Philadelphia. That state was sure to reject the Constitution. Also, as everyone knew, the Philadelphia Convention went far past the point of changing the Articles of Confederation. The delegates wrote a completely new plan of government. But that meant they could agree to accept ratification by fewer than 13 states. Delegates who supported a strong central government wanted to quickly put the question to a vote. How many states were needed to ratify? By the end of the day, the convention had not decided. But early the next day, the delegates voted, and the number they agreed on was 9. The convention in Philadelphia was nearing the end of its work. The delegates needed only to write out their agreements in final form and sign the document. That will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us each week at VOA Learning English for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.